Live from New York, CBS Radio presents CBS News 1966, The Correspondents' Report. Here to open this informal conversation with his colleagues is CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite.
Well, this indeed will be a correspondence report, but also to a considerable degree it will be a correspondence opinion. And that's a luxury that we as broadcast journalists don't permit ourselves during most of the year. But on this occasion, looking back to the past year and forward to the next, well, this will be an exception. My colleagues here are representatives of the vast network of CBS News correspondents at home and overseas, and they have covered most of the major stories of this past year, and our intention is to sort of talk them over between us in this next hour. The correspondents are Eric Severide, our chief national correspondent, Charles Collingwood, our chief foreign correspondent, Mike Wallace, who's been traveling the country testing political sentiment at the grassroots, Roger Mudd, who's been doing much the same but also covers that hottest of political hot centers, Capitol Hill, and Morley Safer, who's just back from the battlefields of Vietnam. Morley, since you're last to be introduced, you should be first to speak, because I'm going to ask you how we're doing out there at the end of this year as compared to a year ago.
It's the old numbers game, Walter. It's a lot bigger than it was a year ago, about twice as big as far as troop commitments concerned. You can't measure success in this war except by numbers. How many enemy have we killed? We've killed a lot more, so we must be doing better. We paid a higher price for it. We've lost a lot of planes over North Vietnam. The attrition of our own troops is about 100 a week. The attrition of enemy, I don't know. They say it's around 1,000 a week. It's possibly high. Credibility gap is something we're going to get into later, I suppose. And we really don't know how well we're doing except by these numbers. And militarily, we assume we can hold off any main force North Vietnamese units, any main force Viet Cong units. In the other war, the war of winning over the people of Vietnam, I think we've probably stood still. A lot of our officials in Saigon are dismayed by the lack of success that has been shown in the pacification and the revolutionary development program. The Vietnamese government, the Vietnamese officials, the Vietnamese army has not been activated in this area. And this is going to be one of the priority areas, I'm sure, next year.
Eric, what about the impact of this war as it drags on through another year and shows no signs of coming to an easy end?
Well, this is one of the hardest things in the world to measure very accurately. Even harder than Morley's problem on the statistics out there, which are almost impossible to confirm. There are a lot of specific effects that you can measure to a degree at home. There's this extra $10 billion thrown into the national economy, the national demand, because of this war, which has generated a considerable inflation this last year. The balance of payments, the imbalance in the balance of payments, the dollar drain, the so-called, has got a bit worse because of this. The gold drain a bit worse. I suppose the most serious effect is in the domestic programs of this administration, the Great Society welfare programs. These are now, much of the mystique and the enthusiasm for all this has gone out, partly because of this war, the sense that you can't do all these things and fight a big war, and this now is a major war. I think we could, in strict economic and financial terms, this country can find the money if it has to, but it's a matter of will and priorities. This is a great opportunity now for very conservative people, don't you think, Roger, in the Congress to speak up with considerable effect on cutting down the Great Society.
Message from last November.
And then, of course, there's this whole kind of spiritual schizophrenia that's developed in the country about the morality of the war. Seems to me we haven't had anything in that respect quite like this since the Mexican War of 1846, when the newspapers of the country, half the educated community, half the Congress, were really at war with one another in very fundamental, passionate matter of the morality. Were we behaving according to the best faiths and themes and principles of this country?
Do you think our will to carry on out there is any less today than it was a year ago?
No, I don't think one could say that. But I think over the next year, if things just go on as they are, and you have these 100 boys a week being killed and many hundreds maimed, you get an escalation of both positions.
I believe the general was more
the hawks and the doves. I don't think one is getting, at the moment, is not silencing the other. And these pressures on the president, of course, have produced a true and historic dilemma on the man in the White House. And it has also, of course, forced in many areas, though not so much in government, in many universities and other study groups, a new look at the very philosophy of American foreign policy, where we are historically, what we are doing with this power, what we ought to be doing with it. Is it running away with us? Is our reach exceeding our grasp? And so on. That's a long subject we could spend a whole hour on.
Well, the whole Vietnam War we could spend the hour on, and we don't intend to. We obviously can't settle it here today. If we could, I assume that we'd be summoned to Washington forthwith, possibly even to Hanoi. General Westmoreland told you, Moreland Charles, in that interview that we had on CBS News last week, that this number of casualties is going up in relation to the number of troops employed. So when Eric says that we're going to suffer some considerable pang with the 100 deaths coming each week, actually that figure's going up to some new figure, isn't it, Moreland?
But I wonder, you know, whether this kind of war isn't something that we kind of learn to live with, like a bad but not fatal illness, so long as it doesn't increase territorially and become more global. Whether we can't just go on, it'll be the kind of national agonizing pastime for students, for intellectuals, for politicians to debate and talk about in 100 a week, or becomes 150
maybe
a week,
we can,
200 a week.
Maybe we can dip into that a little later on, but first, let's ask Charles about the impact of this thing overseas. Eric has told us the impact here at home as he sees it. What about our European friends and allies? Has this thing really undercut our relations, prestige overseas as much as been reported?
Obviously, the war in Vietnam has had an impact among our friends overseas, a well-advertised one. It would be wrong to think that it was monolithic. It would be wrong to ignore the large fractions of public opinion and government opinion which feel that what we're doing is well-advised and necessary and who hope for our success. But this is an unpopular war abroad. Any war today would be unpopular. But given the special characteristics of remoteness, ambiguity, and the sort of David and Goliath aspect of the war, this is doubly unpopular. In a sense, it's been helpful to some European governments. It's given their people a chance to exercise themselves about other people's problems. And they've been contentedly gnawing away at our problems in Vietnam. But unquestionably, it has deeply concerned people. And they've been very audible and visible about it. There are other ways that it has affected our relations with our friends. One of them is the economic thing that Eric was talking about. The drain on America's gold and the impairment of our international balance of payments has had wide and damaging repercussions on the whole intricate, complex machinery of world trade and finance. The problems that seem to beset America's economy and the stock market have also had effects. When Wall Street sneezes, they catch a cold in the Bourse in Paris and the stock exchange in England. There are other things perhaps more subtle. The preoccupation of the United States with Asia now has caused some of our allies on whom with whom we've been in close contact for a long while to feel that we're neglecting them. There's a little bit of the rejected lover aspect. Germany, for instance, when Johnson Polak's Erhard has been widely taken as an indication that we're turning our face away from Europe. But most important of all, I think, is the feeling that because of our involvement in Vietnam and Russia's involvement in helping Hanoi. The war has put a stop to the growing detente, the growing accommodation between East and West. And the furtherance of that accommodation is the principal foreign policy desire of Europe today. And obviously, it has been impaired by this. So there are real impacts on our relations with our friends in Europe, who have been the beneficiaries of a Europe-first policy since Pearl Harbor, and now feel that, if not second-class citizens, at least that America's policy has changed to an Asia-first one.
I wonder how much of this Vietnam policy is truly a consensus American people policy. What was the impact of Vietnam on the election, Mike?
The governors of the 50 states felt that it had very little impact, both at the Republican Governors Association meeting in Colorado Springs and then with the National Governors Conference at White Sulphur Springs. That question was put to the representatives of just about all of the 50 states who were there. And almost without exception, they said that Vietnam was by no means an important or decisive issue. They felt that the issues were rising prices, rising taxes, rising welfare costs, the rising tide of protest against the pace of the Negro Revolution, and Lyndon Johnson. Well, I think it's perfectly sensible to suggest that the other side of that coin, obviously, is the Vietnam War, because the Vietnam War, of course, is operative in all of those areas. But the governors seem to feel that it was an underwriting issue, and really not important in the individual contests around the country in November.
With all those factors being considered, certainly by the men who are going into the 90th Congress that meets a week from Monday, how is Johnson going to deal with that Congress, and how is that Congress going to deal with the president, Roger?
He said yesterday down at the ranch that he thought the nation, the president said, he thought the nation could continue guns and butter. I don't know how much of that was cattle ranch rhetoric. I suspect a great deal of it was. He can't really say anything but we can afford guns and butter. But I think the message of the November elections was that most voting Americans think we can't afford both. We can't afford both the high expenditures of the Vietnam War and these unprecedented massive appropriations for education and the poverty war and beautification and pollution.
Can or cannot?
Cannot. No, I don't think they can. And I think this last session, the second session of the 89th Congress, produced some signs that will make the president think not only twice but three times before he sends up another laundry list of legislative proposals as he did a year ago. The 68 elections are coming. A lot of men on Capitol Hill are going to have to run in 68. Men like Senator Ribicoff of Connecticut already is preparing to pull back a little from the president. There have been signs in this second session of a growing independence on the part of the Congress. The base closings of the veterans' hospitals produced an enormous revolt on Capitol Hill. In addition, the liberals on the Hill, who protested most loudly about our policy in Vietnam, have been unable to come up with any counterproposal. It produced, on the part of the liberals, a great frustration that the president couldn't solve the war. They couldn't solve the war. So what they did was they just put on horse blinders and kept on appropriating money for welfare programs. The president blamed them for continued appropriations, blamed the Congress for exceeding his budget requests. So there increased hostility on both parts. This emboldened the conservatives to cut the budget, and you got a general disaffection between the Democratic liberals and conservatives and the president. He has an enormous consensus, or had until the second session started, but it's broken to pieces. And so my conclusion to the question is that he will send a modest list of requests to the Congress, but really, knowing what's ahead of him, he's not going to work so hard as he might for this, for the Great Society. I don't think the 90th Congress is going to break down the Great Society, but I don't think the Society is going to get any greater.
Eric, do you think the Great Society is dead or dying?
No, I don't think so. These things are on the books. They're not going to be wiped off. one way or another, I would think, in most of these programs, though they may be funded very low for some time to come, people are going to keep working at them. I don't think you can ever go backwards that way. But there is a great disillusionment about them, not just on economic terms or what we can afford, as Roger's talking about, but the fact that they run into a kind of a logjam in terms of the administration of these programs. Now, there are around 250 or 60 federally sponsored, subsidized programs dealing with education, poverty, many areas of human welfare that have to be administered and applied in the cities and the states. Many of whom don't have the right personnel, which is also lack shortage of that in Washington. They simply feel they're in a jungle. They don't understand half of this. They can't sort it out. It's much like the escalation in Vietnam. We piled it all up till you've got a logjam there that doesn't seem to break. I think that's that's why this president's in terrible trouble, because both domestically and abroad, he has started tremendous things that he can't seem to get through the next period. I suppose at some point he may get a second wind. I don't know quite where it's coming from. But the presidency is, you know, really not an administrative function. It's not really a commander. It's a function of moral leadership for the people who got to identify with this one man. And this is now part of his trouble. This is where you get the credibility thing comes into it. It had always been a worry of mine and some other people as to what this president would do if his programs came to a stop or slowed down badly, or his policies abroad. Because people don't really judge a president by the number of laws and this sort of thing. They must feel a certain kinship with him personally. When Eisenhower got in trouble, or Kennedy got in trouble, or Roosevelt, and they all got at the low point of their tenures at one time or another, they had this great personality thing to go on. Even if they couldn't accomplish much, they were that kind of human being to whom people could identify and give sympathy and trust. But Mr. Johnson's public personality is not of that nature, and he's well aware of this. So for him to get a second wind here, I think it's going to be much harder, unless the war comes to some kind of rapid end.
He's got the problem, too, of not really having any major political base, any large group, identifiable group that is all out gung-ho for Lyndon Johnson. Not the liberals, not the South, not a geographical grouping, not business, and in the poverty area, the Negro group, that used to be strong for the Democratic president ever since Roosevelt. That doesn't. What about civil rights? Let's touch on that a second, since I've seen...
Civil rights is a part of everything that Roger and Eric have been talking about. The civil rights movement would seem to be in desperate trouble, both within and without. Within, the moderates, King, Wilkins, Whitney Young, aren't sure what their constituency is. And on the other hand, they have the Stokely Carmichaels and the Floyd McKissicks, who don't seem to have a very large group on their side, and yet they are a very vocal group. And so the split between the moderates, who can't deliver what their constituents want, as Martin Luther King said at the Urban Affairs Committee hearings, the Vietnam War has become a national obsession, the war on poverty is a mere skirmish. Therefore, Washington is not delivering to the civil rights movement what the civil rights movement thinks that it needs.
What does the civil rights movement think it needs? What's it going to ask this Congress for, Roger?
I don't know what the leaders are going to ask for. I suspect that the president won't ask for much. Number one, the House of Representatives is not about to act first and stick its neck out as it did last year and then get its head chopped off by the Senate. Consequently, any initiative for civil rights legislation will have to come this year in the Senate. And you know about the Senate. The Senate will not take the initiative on civil rights simply because it's got that quicksand and the Judiciary Committee waiting for it. What might happen will be certain proposals broken up into separate bills, perhaps a jury reform bill or proposal for some reform in the judiciary, but no omnibus civil rights package. I don't think...
That's not what they're after, though. They're after... they have a good deal of civil rights legislation on the books, but they don't have the money to take advantage of it, a good many of them feel. You ask what they want. I think that Rustin, King, Wilkins, Young all want what they call a freedom budget, which is an expenditure of about $185 billion, over the next 10 years.
Well, they couldn't be serious about that, though.
Well, but they're getting about one-tenth of that as an appropriation right now. What is it? $1.8, $1.7 billion a year. And until the war on poverty is felt, particularly in the cities, then there will continue to be the unhappiness, the demonstrations, the marches, the what Stokely Carmichael calls the rebellions. And so it becomes a vicious circle, because when those marches or rebellions take place in the northern tier of cities, and they are going to take place again, everybody agrees, next summer, that in turn puts up the back of the white community. And that way lies chaos.
Well, do you think that the threat can work? Roger seems to feel it can't, that the backlash in Congress, as shown in the last election, is severe enough that there's not going to be any action.
Well, I just don't think the mood of the Congress, whatever the demands of the leadership are, and they're always great, I don't think the president will mistake the temper of the Congress so much as to go to the mat again as he did in 66 and 65 with another omnibus civil rights bill. It seems to me that whatever consensus Lyndon Johnson has is this great broad section of people in the middle who think now that with the Negroes accusing the administration of a racial war in Vietnam, that the draft working unfairly against the Negroes. I think most white people think this is unpatriotic to talk that way about the war in Vietnam. I think they suspect the Negro leadership of some lack of patriotism. Combined with the huge demands of the Civil Rights Conference last year, the billion-dollar appropriations, I think the white people simply are tired of this incessant demand from Negro leadership. I think that's the way the Congress views it, and I don't think any civil rights bill will have any significant chance of success.
And as you point out, Roger, 2 years from now, a good many of the Democratic liberals from the North are going to have to face election. And they're going to have to face election on the basis of delivering something, hopefully, to their constituency. Ribicoff, whom you mentioned earlier, at the end of the hearings in Urban Affairs, said, if it comes to a question of cutting domestic programs because of the war in Vietnam, I'm for higher taxes. We can't afford not to raise taxes and then sit back while the cities go up in flames.
Well, this is a public position they take, but I don't think that it's been demonstrated that the power of the Negro vote is that great, that it would defeat a man who, as Ribicoff, you quote, would be inclined to retrench on welfare. Harry, do you see any way that this vicious circle is going to be broken?
I don't see it yet, Walter. I have a feeling we're just in the very first stages of a long, drawn-out turmoil that at times will be violent, at other times reasonably quiet.
That's what they say about Vietnam.
Yes, same kind of war, I guess. It's kind of a guerrilla war you're trying to, a pacification thing you're trying to do in the Negro slums of the country. It may be after they lived as slaves 150, whatever it was, years, and technical freedom for 100 that wasn't really a human freedom, that we are in for a very long period of working this out. You cannot expect quick answers, it seems to me, in terms of money and legislation and setting up missions and offices and so on, to a thing that is indigenous to the soul and the whole story of this country, as long as this has been. And it has so many aspects to it beyond the economic, the whole mental state of people who've been obliged to live this way. The contrast, many people live in poverty and don't get upset, but it's the contrast of this onrushing prosperity of the last 25 years right next door to them. I suppose to live in Harlem is like being in a prison with glass walls. You can see right through those walls, the Fifth Avenue, the rest of it, and the great rich life and all the magazines show them and the television, all the rest of it, but you can't touch it. Now, what does this do to the psyche of people in that condition, and how do you iron that out? I don't know.
The simple fact is that the Negro unemployment rate really has doubled since 1954. It's 2.5 times the white unemployment rate, and the Stokely Carmichaels and the Floyd McKissicks count upon that when they talk about black power to inflame and hopefully to coalesce the Negro community. And yet black power, it seems to me, has been about as unfortunate a phrase as has been used in the history of the civil rights movement in the last decade.
To use phrases like that and some of the techniques they have used, which has made the rest of the country think of this not in terms of justice for people, but whether we have public order or anarchy in this country, which is a very primitive political issue and set of responses. To do this when you are a 12% minority in the country seems to me is going to be, it may get certain advantages up to a point, but it could lead to a really serious bloodshed and trouble, I think.
It hasn't proved so far, however, to coalesce the Negroes behind those who advocate black power, which presumably would be its principal purpose, would be to raise a banner by which a certain group could seize control of the Negro Revolution. That has not worked.
Bayard Rustin says that Stokely Carmichael is in what he calls a no-win policy. And it does seem to be that. And the SNCC people, just within the last month, have met again. They met for 10 days, and their plan for next summer is to be more militant than ever. There are even those, Walter, some in the civil rights movement, who say that the anti-poverty workers look with a certain relish to riots in the northern cities.
Most of these riots so far, am I not right in this, Mike? And you know more than I do about it, but most of the riots, except some of the housing thing in Chicago recently, have not been, strictly speaking, race riots. They have been riots started among the Negroes, involved other Negroes sometimes fighting between themselves. But a collision of the two groups, of the two races, has happened very rarely in this. That really wasn't what...
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, it's not like, for example, Chicago around 1919 or whatever it was, Tulsa, Detroit, those terrible, real race riots where masses of whites fought masses of Negroes. They had one in Washington back around that period. We could get into that phase, I suppose.
There are arms in the city of Chicago among whites.
Yes,
this time.
Arms on both sides.
That's correct.
What were you about to say, Mike, about the anti-poverty people welcome these riots?
Some of the anti-poverty people, this has been told to me by a couple of Negro leaders, some of the anti-poverty people welcome the riots because they feel that's the only way that they're going to get money.
That's an old foreign aid technique. A small country puts a communist in the cabinet and right away they get more attention from the United States.
They think that's the only way, or the best way, the quickest way to get more money is through these riots and or rebellions in the cities. And then the street Negro looks upon them in summertime as a kind of circus.
We're kind of legislating by bludgeon, aren't we, these days? What's the impact of all this going to be in 1968? Let's talk about 1968 a minute. How clear is the crystal ball out here in the middle of our table? What do you see as the potential? Well, take the Democratic Party first. Do you see any possible challenge to President Johnson for renomination?
I put that question to John Connolly a couple of weeks ago, and his face cracked into a big smile, and he said, "Do you really believe that a man as proud and as political as Lyndon Johnson is going to tuck tail and run when things are a little tough?" He said, "Barring something totally unforeseen, barring bad health," and Connolly, after all, is a man who knows the president pretty well, and he thinks that president's health is in good shape, all things considered. He just doesn't see Lyndon Johnson not running again.
I suppose it's within the realm of possibility that the bone in the president's throat, the Vietnam bone, could choke him so violently that he would just give up. Is so frustrated in his job, realizing that all the genius of the democratic form of government, all the power he's brought to bear on the Vietnam War, that the Vietnam War still defies solution, that it could so defeat him personally, physically, mentally, that he would think a long time before he decided to run again. I think that's possible. I don't think it's probable. But the question is, if he decides to seek renomination, whether anybody could put together a block in the convention that could successfully...
Who would be the replacement, Roger?
Think anybody's trying to put together such a block?
I don't think so. I've heard... Some people in Washington are convinced he won't run again for health. discouragement, so forth. I don't think so. I think he will be the nominee, and I don't think anybody's going to stop him.
Well, Roger, you remember in 48 when Mr. Truman wasn't doing very well, and some of the younger bloods in his party suggested that they go out and get a fellow named Eisenhower, then sitting in Paris, and run him on the Democratic ticket. This was put down
pretty quickly.
Very easily.
The last time anybody ever was defeated for renomination, I believe I'm right, was Chester Arthur back in 1884, and that was under special circumstances. He'd alienated all of the party leaders with his civil service reform, his pursuit of graft and corruption. Let's come back to this political crystal ball just a moment.
Keep up to the minute on major news of the world, nation, and neighborhood with CBS News over the CBS radio network.
Vacationing by car? Then these National Safety Council reminders should come in handy. Pack the car so that the driver's vision is always unobstructed. Use a top carrier if the trunk load seems to distort steering or headlight aim. Before starting your trip, increase tire pressure at least 4 pounds to compensate for the extra load. Remember that a heavily loaded car won't permit you to accelerate as quickly or slow down as quickly, so allow extra time for passing and stopping.
What about the Republican side of the picture? Who do you see as likely in 68? Mike?
Well, the horse betters who understand the morning line. I think the morning line is in favor of George Romney. He seems...
What's the morning line?
When the Daily Telegraph comes out in the morning. That's the way it shapes up before the
good
day's race.
Eric, I don't think we have time to go into that.
Sorry you said it, Mike.
Well, certainly Romney's nomination would be the worst news the Democratic Party could get, would be bad news for President Johnson, simply because the contrast between Romney and Johnson would be sharpest. Between Nixon and Johnson would not be so sharp.
He certainly wants Nixon as his opponent.
That's right. You get into the used car and new car syndrome as to which one sells which, and I think the comparison between Romney and Johnson would be greater. Johnson suffers from that wheeler-dealer feeling that people have some suspicion about the president. And when Romney comes on, he with the gray temples, you know, and that rock jaw and that forceful manner, they believe him, whether he's telling the truth or not.
As an objective observer from outside, only seeing the digests of what the press says about Romney, they figure that he cuts. Do you think Romney could stand a hard primary campaign with these circumlocutions, evasions of issues, resounding cliches?
He's great at that, Charles. I think he could. He gets his sweat clothes back on.
I think it's worked.
It's a primary dash, sure.
Ho Chi Minh seems to be the man who has all the answers.
But I think probably...
Surely. No, but what I was going to ask, what would... Not spectacular success, because I don't think anyone expects it, but a measure of success in Vietnam due to it, the political race here. Would the president automatically...
Almost, it would seem to me that if there was some settlement, half honorable, before 1968, it would dissolve 75% of the president's problems.
Half honorable.
If it was a settlement that we could accept without being overcome by a great wave of shame, a massive withdrawal, troops boarding up and ships sailing home.
Any break here in the direction of negotiations or a real measurable, visible wearing down of the enemy in the field would, either one, of course, would be the greatest thing could happen to President Johnson. I think his whole energy now is that all the inner calculations in the White House, Washington generally, must be to find a way to get this kind of break, and along with it, perhaps a reshuffling of his top men to some degree in the next few months.
What you're
saying? A fresh face and a new breath he has to have. He's perfectly aware of this.
Well, then this election could be settled in the last 2 months before November 68 by manipulation of the war in Vietnam.
That's too strong a word. And he reserves new programs social welfare things. Until 68, in that session of Congress, to come in with something that sounds fresh and something for everybody again, and we would have been doing it for 25 years, and then he can probably ride through this and be reelected.
It seems clear that the enemy is not going to crack. He's going to die before he cracks. They're not going to be forced to the negotiating table at the point of an airstrike.
Let's get back to the Vietnam thing. We want to come back to it before we get through here, but let's settle this political thing if we can just for a moment. We've only mentioned one name, Romney, and Nixon.
And Nixon.
Brought in parenthetically. Are you that convinced that that's the way this is going to go?
I am. I think that Romney is going to do as he already is doing, organize his team, get his money raises working. He has, after all, a tremendous amount of strength, really, around the country that is, I'm told, committed to him. You start with Volpe in Massachusetts and Chafee and Rockefeller, Scranton, Schaefer. I understand that Charles Percy is more or less willing to have Romney prove to him, Tom McCall in Oregon, John Love in Colorado, Mark Hatfield, all of these people are willing to go for the time being with Romney. And then as he makes his positions evident over a period of the next year, they will decide whether indeed he is the man or not.
Can he make the peace with the conservatives and still keep the support of these people you mentioned in the more progressive wing of the party?
I think that there are two things that Romney has to prove. One, he has to show the conservatives, the political pros within the party, that he, without saying that he's repented, that he has repented. And if you wait just a second, the other thing is the press.
Well, this is the point I wanted to make, Mike. This
yes.
is the first hurdle, isn't it?
The press.
You know, the difference between the popular impression of Romney and the impression of the working press and the columnists and others who follow him and listen to him a great deal is a very big difference.
Yeah.
And now, I don't know how influential the press or our part of the press is in these things. Maybe public images and all this mean much more, and people are not going to pay attention to what so-called informed people write and say. Sometimes I think they just don't. But it seemed obvious to me out there in Colorado Springs with these Republican governors that there's a real risk here of this kind of press really turning sour on this man. They're not very impressed with his style of oratory, his bee-fighting technique of political preachments. And this creeps in the copy and the broadcast and all of this. But whether it's going to hurt him with people, I don't know.
His people are concerned about it, but at the same time, they say it makes him a very interesting alternative to Foxy Grandpa, which is their...
Who is that?
That's the president.
Well, I was just going to say, you're kind of bringing up a possible Romney credibility gap, but the credibility gap, the difference between what is said and what are the facts, has been laid to at the door of President Johnson. It's a considerable matter of discussion these days. How serious is the credibility gap? You as reporters watching this develop around the world, how serious is it? Roger?
Well, it's serious on Capitol Hill, I think. People tell you things about the president, and there's a certain marvel at what he does and what he says he's going to do and what he follows through on. I think it's affected him deeply on Capitol Hill, and I think there's a resentment about the general treatment.
Eric, do you think it's going to be a major factor in 68?
Well, if the thing doesn't change now, I would think it would be. That's one more thing that contributes to the general malaise and uneasiness and sort of sense of doubt in the country. I have never seen in all the years I've been in and out of Washington, that goes back quite a ways now, anything quite like this phenomenon. We never used a phrase like that before, credibility gap.
You don't believe your president, yeah.
I think it's bad because it's in a difficult context here. I think a great many people are not sure whether they believe what the administration says because they're so confused about what the administration does. That is, the gap between what we proposed to do in Vietnam and what we've actually been able to do, the jam up on all the domestic programs that people don't really feel in their bones and pocketbooks too much, a sense of a lost momentum. And this is a kind of a country, and we have the kind of psychology that is activist. We require this sense of motion to feel united, that we're going somewhere, and they do not have this feeling today. And this makes the credibility thing all that much more important and rather ominous. There is another kind of credibility gap, which does not have to do with whether you believe they're telling the truth or not, but it has to do with whether they make sense in their honest efforts to explain why we're in Vietnam, let's say. That is the official rhetoric that has developed, which is, in effect, in the minds of a good many people, old hat. It's out of date. It's an application of the old Cold War or World War II ways of thinking. Freedom is indivisible and peace is indivisible and so on, applied to this little place in Asia. The escalation, the intellectual escalation of the issue and the place and the nature of the fight into something of apocalyptic proportions. Mr. Rusk talks about it as a great test case. If you lose this, then practically half the world collapses, and you have guerrilla wars all over Africa and Latin America and so on. This apotheosizing of this fight, to many people, and particularly patriotic people, and very scholarly people, this is not in accordance with the historic realities as they see them. They think we have inflated this thing out of all normal proportions, that the course of history is something different. Now, that's a credibility gap of a kind, and I think this is going to get more and more of a serious argument. This kind of re-examination of American foreign policy in terms of this historical moment on the clock, the basis, the philosophical basis of our policy and approach to the world with this great power, this re-examination is not really going on in Washington or in the government. It's going on in universities and quite a lot of places. Very good books on this subject. This, I think, is what Fulbright has on his mind, and I think you're going to hear more of this, probably through his committee and through other efforts in the Congress this year. Mr. Mansfield wants a re-examination of all our domestic programs, not to push through more things, but I think that same will happen in terms of foreign policy, because there is not a great deal of... people are not together in the credibility of the explanation of the war.
I don't think the credibility is challenged primarily because of a lack of candor regarding this war. Morley knows only too well, Charles, all of us who, Eric, and all of us who have been out to Vietnam, that a year and a half ago, men on the ground said we were going to 400,000 men at a time when here at home we were told it was 150 or 200,000 or something was the goal. Now they're talking toward 1 million, and Washington's come around to 500,000, perhaps. The recent spate of stories out of Hanoi by Harrison Salisbury on bombing, when we were being told a patent that any military correspondent certainly knows, a patent falsehood that we weren't hitting civilians. Now we admit, on the basis of a free reporter's dispatches, that we are hitting civilians, because you can't help it. This is the credibility.
Walter, the doubt really goes right back to the beginning. All of these things would be acceptable and wouldn't be regarded as a credibility gap if there was total belief in the thing in the first place.
Charles, how has it hit us overseas, this credibility gap?
Well, the credibility gap overseas, which is very real, is on two levels. It's on a personal level and an institutional level. And there's no question that it's been exacerbated by the war in Vietnam, the confusion surrounding it, by Lyndon Johnson himself, whom they only see over there on the television, and they read the speeches and some comments. And he's not the kind of American that they instinctively warm to. Their idea of a president was Roosevelt or Adlai Stevenson, who never was, Jack Kennedy, people like that. And this lugubrious regional figure, when he makes a speech, they always feel that he's not really telling them everything. He's trying to sell them something. Undoubtedly, on this level, combined with the problems of the Vietnam War and the explanation of the Vietnam War, combined with the changes in American foreign policy toward the world, have caused the credibility of the president to suffer. And that, in turn, has exaggerated a long-term problem of credibility which the United States has faced ever since they began to worry about the United States as a great power. And that is simply that people abroad do not see us as we see ourselves. They see us, they listen to our rhetoric and find that it is different from our acts. They find that our pretensions of universal rectitude, of helping the common good, only conceals our basic self-interest. They don't think that we're disinterested. They just assume that we didn't pretend to be. This is a problem which antedates President Johnson, which reached its highest point, I suppose, in Eisenhower's administration, whom they found perfectly credible because they knew him. They weren't all that enthusiastic about him. But the policies of his administration, Suez, the great rollback, Hungary, John Foster Dulles in general, they found quite incredible. And I suspect that this problem has been exacerbated now. It has, to some perhaps measurable degree, undermined the influence of the United States abroad, or at least, if not undermined the influence, at least has damaged our reputation and caused second thoughts of those whom we wish to lead.
But how does one explain, in spite of what all that's been said here about the lack of attachment to the president abroad, these enormous public welcomes in places like New Zealand and Australia, everywhere he went on this Asian trip, people listening to him with rapt attention.
He represents,
turned out by the hundreds of thousands.
He represents the United States of America in those areas, the most visible, the greatest power, and it is still true that the highest degree of credibility in the world comes from power. And we have it. And Johnson is the representative of that power, and thus an object of great interest and curiosity.
Well, and how do you explain also Fulbright's failure in the last session to mobilize public opinion? He went to the nation on television and tried to mobilize opinion against the war, and he failed.
Well, he doesn't know how to solve the war. He says this. It's an impasse, a dilemma.
But I get
what he's trying to do is, I don't think he's trying to mobilize anybody. I think he's trying to educate people. I think he's going to go back to that, try to get back again to these philosophical premises of American foreign policy. For example, we have gone on here now a good many years with a kind of intellectual triangulation of peace, prosperity, material prosperity, and democracy because of our own internal experience for 150 years, at least in my view. We put this outward on the world, and in every other speech you read now from State Department or the White House, this concept is put forward again, that these three things are interdependent. They're all very good in themselves, each one, but is there a cause and effect relationship between them? We've seen the bursting of the bubble of democracy in Africa, of the bubble of attempts at material progress in much of Latin America, partly because of the burst thing. And what the relationship of this is to peace is a very vague thing. This is the American faith out of our experience, but is it becoming now a kind of American ideology?
Maybe,
a dogma.
But it's not an ignoble faith, Eric.
It's not ignoble, it's historically accurate.
And it's a faith which is shared by a great many people in all these places where you say it hasn't worked.
Well, you just said, Charles, that in Europe they do not credit the nobility of our impulses and proclamations.
True enough, but they still cherish a fundamental belief that there is a connection between prosperity, peace, democracy, and the orderly world that everyone wants.
In Vietnam, they have no illusions, or they claim to have no illusions about our commitment and our presence, and they believe in it only so far as we're prepared to continue it. They don't place any moral reasons for our presence in Vietnam. We're there for, in our own self-interest, to defend a cause that they're not very clear about. They can't really understand the commitment. They somehow feel that we think we're threatened by North Vietnam or the Viet Cong and so forth, therefore we're there. Which accounts for, to some degree, for the lack of enthusiasm.
for the war, for our presence in Vietnam. We're not welcome with open arms there.
Gentlemen, we're moving on toward the end of an, unfortunately for us at any rate, a short hour. Hope that those who share this with us feel the same way. But I wonder if we could get some kind of quick answers on a couple of subjects we haven't even touched on. Rather quick answers. On de Gaulle, for instance, is he any more credible in Europe than we are?
De Gaulle is very credible in Europe because he has a remarkable reputation as a prophet. He has proved right on a great many things, on the way the world is changing, right on his prediction that the United States would be increasingly involved in Asia, less so in Europe, that NATO would begin to wither away, on a great many things. However, his credibility suffers, just as Johnson's is fundamentally increased, by the power status of France. France, with all its affluence, with all its grandeur, with all its glamour, is still not one of the great powers in the world. And that limits the credibility of the vast and grandiose plans which de Gaulle likes to throw before the world.
What about another corner of the world, China? We haven't even mentioned China. Is all hope of rapprochement between Moscow and Peking now at an end?
No, of course it isn't. But what's happening now is just what happens in any three-handed game. In any three-handed poker game, two people tend to line up against the other. We've seen Russia and China side against us. Now that China and Russia are at odds, we see a distinct rapprochement between the United States and Russia, which is impaired at the moment by the problems of Vietnam and Russia's commitment to North Vietnam. Were that to go away, I'm sure we would see a much greater one. But when another hand is dealt, it's quite possible that this two against one change will take another form.
How serious is the present internal revolution in China? Is this going to deeply affect this nation? What do the China watchers feel out in the Far East, Morning?
The most important thing about China and its involvement in the Vietnam War is that it's not costing China a penny, really. That the war goes on to their advantage, their influence in North Vietnam on Hanoi is limited. And they feel at the moment that perhaps that they're not overly committed in to North Vietnam is a good thing, simply because of the difficulties they are having at home themselves, that fighting a war on two fronts would not be the best thing for them at the moment. Charles, you've just been China watching as well.
Well, I think it's very serious. Unquestionably, any change of regime or any internal disorganization is serious. This Red Guard movement, with all of its implications, the way in which it can get out of hand, is undoubtedly causing great tremors within China. No one knows, the clearest China watcher, how it's going to come out. But it certainly would appear to lessen the effectiveness of China in her external affairs because of the preoccupation with her internal convulsion.
Charles, you've made frequent trips and had frequent stays in Vietnam, and kind of as a final go-round here, do you see any satisfactory way out of the Vietnam War? I'm not asking what's going to happen, but let's get some opinion here. Do you see any way out?
I see an ideally satisfactory way, which would probably be involve a return to the Geneva formula, which was reached in 1954. This is not a novel thought. When I say a return, I don't mean to that precise document. To return to the general principles, which would be revised and updated. This is something I talked to Anthony Eden, who was chairman, co-chairman of the thing in 1954, this summer. It's what Utant suggested yesterday. It's what George Brown, the present British foreign minister, has suggested. It could work. It could have worked in 1954 if John Foster Dulles hadn't sabotaged it. It could work again. At least enough to give a breathing spell for the world, and a breathing spell to Vietnam to sort itself out and reach whatever accommodation they
feel they want to reach. The problem, though, is whether or not this commends itself to Ho Chi Minh and Hanoi. So far, it has not. He's been burnt in previous negotiations by inscrutable Westerners dealing with simple-minded Orientals in Geneva and elsewhere. He doesn't like it. He banks on the assumption that his will, North Vietnam's will, to continue this struggle is greater than that of the United States. And after listening to some of you, Eric and Roger and Mike, I'm not sure that Ho Chi Minh isn't right.
Morley, what about your view of a satisfactory solution?
I don't think it's going to be as simple as that. I don't believe you think it's going to be very simple either. But Ho has been forced, through circumstances and us, to commit himself absolutely on this. There's very little room for negotiation.
I haven't seen a North Vietnam, any Vietnamese commit himself absolutely to anything.
Well, they've committed themselves to the extent of putting a field army in South Vietnam, as we have, and in support of a civil war in South Vietnam. I don't think anything is going to happen, any kind of peace is going to be possible, until we recognize and use our influence on the government of South Vietnam to recognize the Viet Cong as an important, the only workable, viable political organization in South Vietnam, and it has to be involved in any government of South Vietnam. Its voice must be heard.
Eric, have you got a solution since Fulbright does not?
Not at all. I suppose you either are going to get some movement toward negotiation fairly soon, or the war is just going to wear on and on and on and possibly peter out. But if you're talking about a final solution to the whole area, in terms of a free society in Vietnam, in terms of stability in Southeast Asia, then I would doubt very much that anything satisfactory in relationship to the price that we are paying would ever come about in our time. I think the price has been too high.
Saying that this is going on forever?
Price, I think, is out of relationship to the product you are apt to get.
In terms of Vietnam, but of course there have been other things, haven't there? There have been the change in Indonesia. There's been the reluctance of China to push its fight against India, all of which I think can be laid to the door of our stand, our credibility.
I don't agree with that at all. Indonesia. I think those are peripheral products that are of extremely doubtful how much that had to do with Vietnam. But that's another argument to this period in the hour, Charles.
It's another one that I wish we could have gotten into among many here today. We could go on like this, I'm sure, for hours. Perhaps we have one thing we could say illuminated on Vietnam are the problems, if not the solutions at any rate. One thing we might also say, I think we'd all agree on pretty well, is that while there are some who criticize the news media for failure to report the war clearly with confusion and complexity, it's because the facts of the war are confusing and complex, and not through any failure of the news media. We've left uncovered many areas today I wish we could have gotten into, but it'd take many hours to do so. Perhaps one thing did come through clearly, it did to me at any rate, and that's that far more than in the past surveys we've made at the end of the year, it seems a fairly clear, stands out in bold relief, that the year ahead for America is not so much one of a crisis of action as perhaps a crisis of conscience. Good day.
The preceding live broadcast has been presented under the supervision of CBS News. This has been CBS News 1966, the Correspondence Report. This is the CBS Radio Network.